From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
I told my husband that you have to leave, you have to go home. I cannot stay like this for the whole night. It's not going to be possible to cross the border.
We are licensed for 94 patients. We have 96 here, so we're operating sort of extra legally, strictly speaking.
Ultimately, though, I've had way more peanut butter and jam sandwiches than I've ever had hot dogs, so I'm going to live forever. That's all I'm taking from that story. Eternal life.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, is the Pope any good at foosball? What to do when a pine marten eats your car? And how to deal with all those school parental WhatsApp groups? That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that will be parking its car in a sealed container from now on. Well, let's start at the beginning and the morning musings from the Ryan Tuberty Show. And on his show this morning, Ryan talked about taking his mother to see Fast and Furious 9 in the cinema, following yesterday's jolly film chat.
I went to the cinema yesterday with my mother. We went to see The Courier.
Oh, okay. The Rock's in that, I think. So maybe that must be why I got it wrong.
The Courier stars Benedict Cumberbatch, who...
Yikes. Cumberbatch. Cumberbatch and The Rock. Come on. Only their mothers can tell them apart.
I think he's pretty much brilliant in everything he's in, as far as I'm concerned. I'm a big fan of his. I didn't know much about it. I just knew it was a kind of Cold War, Cuban Missile Crisis type thing. I said, that's enough for me. I don't want to know anything else. I want to go in cold, blank check, and see what happened. Only problem really was, it wasn't my normal cinema, so it was one of the... it was a different one. I don't want to call it out because there's nothing wrong with it. The problem was with me. To get the ticket, you had to... the very nice person behind the counter said, you just have to go over to that screen over there and start putting in emails, and I know it was safety, and I've done that with everywhere I go, but it was pretty convoluted, and especially when you're not tech savvy, as one of my colleagues said to me one day as I was struggling with my computer, and I said, I need help, I don't know how anything works. And she said, you know, I've told you this before, I'm going to say it again, and she said, you know, that's learned helplessness. You can actually fix this yourself. She no longer works with us, but she no, I'm joking. She's still upstairs. But it was just a bit tricky. But we got there, got the popcorn, sat down and watched this. And on comes before I knew it, there's Jesse Buckley, Kerry's finest, plays the wife with a lovely clipped English accent. Perfect, pitch perfect. And what's the name? Benedict Cumberbatch playing, based on a true story, an English man who's roped in by MI5 or MI6, whatever, to be a spy, to go to Russia to work with a counterpart over there. So it is it's a lovely, it was perfect afternoon. Mother enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. We went home. We stopped off for milk. Everything was fine. You know, that kind of way. And no one was unhappy. In fact, I think she was more impressed by the machine with the ticket purchasing. That was what she was talking about for most of the journey. What about that screen? I said, no, there was a whole movie about the Cold War. Yeah, but the screen, I know. But what about the bomb, the missile crisis? It was a most enjoyable afternoon.
Would have been even better if The Rock had been in it, though. So, how many hot dogs is your life made up of?
Every hot dog a person eats will shorten your life by 36 minutes. Now you know. I've often said my death row meal would be a hot dog from New York with a cold can of Coke. And I never eat hot dogs at home. I've never made them. I tried them once, but it just didn't work out. So I'm not really a fan. I fear what's in the hot dog in the Frankfurt. I dread to think. I love decent sausages, but I dread to think what's in a hot dog. I have fear. So I just go for it in New York. I dread to think what class of water they're made in, and I just go for it. I just think if I'm there, it's rare, and it's all part of the experience with loads of ketchup and mustard, and it's the vibe, isn't it? It's the place, it's the smells around you, it's the pretzels, it's the yellow cabs, it's the highest buildings, it's the thought of going out that night in East Village for a few drinks. It's all of that. It's a combined experience, not just the food in your hand. Reading further into this article, which is complete nonsense, I see that, like, let's face it, 36 minutes, you see? You can add to your life by eating certain foods. And I see that one of my favourites, as you know, as somebody, one of you actually, who sent in a message to me saying you have a nursery palate. It's so true. I eat like a child. And it's one food stuff that will add to your life. And I did some absolutely nonsensical calculations on this one, whereby if you have a peanut butter and jam sandwich, that gives you more than half an hour extra life. Now, I'm very pleased to hear that I'm a fan of peanut butter and jam as a sandwich, especially crunchy peanut butter. It's the only problem with it is, which do you put on first, the jam or the peanut butter, and what do you do with the knife and in terms of putting it into the, and so on. But that's okay. These are all problems we can overcome. Ultimately, though, I've had way more peanut butter and jam sandwiches than I've ever had hot dogs, so I'm going to live forever. That's all I'm taking from that story. Eternal life. Done. And speaking of New York, New York marks its emergence from the worst of the pandemic with a star-studded free concert in Central Park. Do you remember those? Concerts, children. Concerts were where people who played instruments and sang songs went on a stage, and then we, humans, would sit down, maybe stand up, and watch them, occasionally gyrating our hips. That's called dancing. We haven't done that for a long, long time because it's in the past. But now that we're all vaccinated, we're still puzzled as to why we can't do it yet. I don't know what's happening, kids. We're all learning, and we're all in this together. Just open the venue. We need to dance and sing. However, back to the story, New York, they've got their act together. We love New York, the homecoming concert. It's been advertised out the door on CNN, I noticed, at this concert, featuring Bruce Springsteen, Barry Manilow, Andrea Bocelli, gosh, The Killers, Patti Smith, Polo G, I'm just going to say that like I know it, never heard of her, and the New York Philharmonic, and Paul Simon in the middle of it all. What a day out, or a night out. And it is going to be attended by about 60,000 people and live streamed on CNN. Sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, if only we had some musicians and some spaces they could perform in here in Ireland. Meanwhile,
in the Irish Examiner today, in other news, more than 2/3 of children with autism have developed a rather new COVID-related behaviours, such as refusing to leave the family home, a new fear of death, excessive hand washing and hygiene routines, or an obsession with news coverage of the pandemic. And this is a study from lead author Dr. Sinead Smith, School of Psychology, DCU, found that some young people with autism had demonstrated declines in many skills during the second school closure in early 2021. And it was anxiety was the most important thing that was happening. Issues around routine, sleep, emotional regulation, all big problems. Decline in skills and abilities reported. Daily living skills and toileting declined, all the essentials. She writes, it's clear from these findings that children and their parents are experiencing a multitude of unique challenges as a result of the pandemic restrictions, continuous uncertainty amid imposition, relaxation and reimposition of restrictions and closures. So you think you have it bad, but that is a proper study of what's happening in the lives of families who have autism in their world. So you're not on your own. It's a problem, and that's what's happening. So hopefully answers will be forthcoming.
Will they, though? Will they really? Maybe we should ask the Holy Father.
Pope Francis, meanwhile, has received dozens of soccer jerseys and game balls during his 8-year pontificate. But he got a new football-themed toy on Wednesday, and I'm looking at a picture of him having a go at his very own foosball table. He's having a look at that. Spinning. Francis played around. It's a game I've played and regularly, but it puts me on edge. I find the nerves go a bit trying to hold the ball and then not getting it and then having to rattle the table to move it along. And anyway, it's fine. But back to Pope Francis, more importantly. He played around on the table. It was given to him at the end of his general audience by representatives of a Tuscany-based football, Table Football Association. And the mayor of this area wrote on Facebook that the table was designed to be inclusive and work for people with physical disabilities to encourage their participation in sports. So good on him. And now the Pope has a papal foosball table in the Vatican.
More stories of sport and human goodness.
Days after the Tokyo Olympics, a Polish javelin thrower auctioned off her silver medal. And why would she do such a thing after such a glorious achievement? She did it to help pay for a child's heart surgery. What a nice thing to do. Maria Magdalena Antrajcik announced that she would sell her medal and put the proceeds towards an operation for an 8-month-old child who is under home hospice care, needs urgent operation in the United States. And they announced the winner, who paid $125,000 for the silver medal. And it was a Polish convenience store chain called Zabka said, we'll pay for it. We'll buy the medal, to which is very generous. I presume it's like their local spa or center or whatever. And instead of collecting the prize, the chain store said that the athlete could keep the silver medal. We'll give you the money, keep the medal. So the gesture was beautiful. Then the company came along and said, you can hold on to your medal, but we'll give the money into the charity. And It's lovely. They said, we were moved by the beautiful and extremely noble gesture of our Olympian. And that's a very, very nice thing to do. And good on them and good on one and all for getting involved in that. That's very sweet.
In fairness, ending the newsings with a good news story. You're welcome. The medical director of the Central Mental Hospital, Dr. Harry Kennedy, has admitted that the facility is breaking the law by turning away patients committed to it by the courts due to capacity issues. Today with Claire Byrne reporter Barry Lenehan told Philip Boucher-Hayes what he found when he visited the Central Mental Hospital in Dublin.
This is an old Victorian building behind imposing 18-foot walls in Dundrummond. Capacity problems, they were sharply highlighted last March when Gardaí and staff engaged in a three-hour standoff at the gates of the hospital after staff refused to admit a severely mentally ill man committed there by the courts. It's believed that incident was referred to the Garda Síochána Ombudsman Commission, who declined to comment when contacted yesterday. Now, the medical director of the Central Mental Hospital, Dr. Harry Kennedy, says the hospital is no longer able to fulfil its legal obligations as it can't accept all patients sent to it by the courts, as it simply doesn't have enough beds. As a result, 25 severely mentally ill patients are kept in prisons this morning instead. And Dr. Kennedy says prison staff and prisoners must deal with often unmedicated patients who require the specialist treatment and so are at risk of injury or attack. Here's what else he told me.
Currently, we're actually over capacity, so we are licensed for 94 patients. We have 96 here, so we're operating sort of extra legally, strictly speaking. So our situation is highly difficult, but that's pretty much the sort of difficulty we've been living with literally for decades.
We're looking at a building here that was in the 1990s said it wasn't fit for purpose. It said it shouldn't be operational anymore, and yet here we are still. What is the impact of that?
The impact is pretty dire, to be honest with you. So this is a building which was established by the London Parliament in an act of 1845, and it was open, fully built, open and operational in 1850. Facilities are very, very unsafe. They're doubly unsafe in the year of COVID, but they're also unsafe when we're treating patients who might be suicidal and patients who are violent to each other or to other people. Obviously, we would much prefer to be in the new building because fundamentally it's a safer and more therapeutic environment, and fundamentally because the capacity to admit and treat people will be much increased. And that's really our biggest worry. At the moment, we have people in prison on our waiting list who are in entirely the wrong place and should be here in hospital. We have people before the courts, where the courts are making orders that are legally binding on us and we're not able to obey them. So it's a pretty difficult position. Yes, we would prefer to be in the new hospital, and we will be, I hope, very soon.
How many prisoners are there at the moment who should be here but aren't?
There are about 4,000 people in custody in the prisons. About 25 of them at any one time are on our waiting list for urgent admission. That's the situation at the moment. At times it's been higher. It can go up to 40 sometimes.
If a judge makes an order in the morning to say not guilty by reason of insanity and somebody should come here, are you able to adhere to that order, do you know?
No, I can tell you that situation has arisen in recent months, and we are in breach of our legal obligations. We are unable to meet our obligations. It means that we instruct lawyers and barristers, and we go into court and we abjectly apologise. Judge gets annoyed and the patient waits.
What's the impact of the patient waiting then?
Sometimes the patient is very unwell, with very limited ability that we have to admit. As doctors, you pick the most severely ill that you need to do the most urgent treatment with, and you admit them. And often when we go into court, what we're doing is explaining to the judge that their defendant before them, of course, has a need, but there are 20 other patients who aren't before that judge, who have more urgent needs, and we have to balance these out. And sometimes you find yourself asking the judge, is there somebody you would like me to discharge from the hospital before they're ready to go? Or which of these patients do you want your client to jump ahead of? And at that point, judges who are very humane and very rational people understand the rationality of the process.
What's the other side of that for those who are in prisons, whether inmates or staff, to have these patients left there?
You now have severely mentally ill people who go without treatment in a way that wouldn't happen in the community. And you have people who are not nurses obliged to try and care for them. By the time people do get admitted, after very long waits, during which time they've been refusing medication because they lack insight, they are really, really very severely ill by the time they come here. The busiest, the most acute, and the most severely ill units for severely mentally ill people are actually in the prisons, waiting to get into hospitals.
Dr. Harry Kennedy, Medical Director of the Central Mental Hospital, talking to Barry Lenehan. Barry went on to tell Philip what effect the inability to accept patients to the CMH is having on the prison service.
Well, earlier this month, the Inspector of Prisons identified a waiting list to get on a waiting list for access to the Central Mental Hospital at Clover Hill Prison. And chaplains in the state's 12 prisons, they've expressed concern in their recent annual reports about what's happening. The chaplain of the Dorcas Women's Prison says the facility is being used as, quote, a dumping ground for psychiatric illness, and the current situation has the makings of a scandal of the future. And several chaplains right around the country highlighted how staff in prisons are ill-equipped to deal with mental health issues. Now, the watchdog, the Council of Europe Committee for the Prevention of Torture and Degrading Treatment, last year expressed concern at what it witnessed in Irish prisons around mental health. Molly Joyce, Legal and Public Affairs Manager with the Irish Penal Reform Trust, picks up the story.
So it describes scenes of seeing mentally ill prisoners lying naked in a cell. So one example, a man lying naked in a cell, the cell smeared with feces and puddles of urine on the floor. Staff only going in and opening the door to the cell in order to provide food. Mentally ill prisoners not being given showers or access to out of cell time. General inadequate treatment regimes and a lack of kind of purposeful activities for people in some of the units where mentally ill prisoners are being held. It also describes scenes of mentally ill prisoners being required to sleep on mattresses on the floor because the units were simply overcrowded. And it also really highlighted perhaps one of the things that was most striking. It's concerned that there was a rising number of mentally ill homeless people ending up in prison in Ireland simply on the basis that those people, because they are of no fixed abode, were not able to be accepted by any HSE community mental health team services. And so therefore, when the court didn't have anywhere else to send them, they sent them to prison.
Are there concerns around transfer time from prisons to the Central Mental Hospital at present?
2019, the average waiting time for transfer from prison to the CMH was approximately 121 days. And most recently, we saw from the Inspector of Prisons report on Clover Hill Prison, one prisoner in Clover Hill had been waiting for 305 days for transfer, and another for 294, and another for 228 days.
Molly Joyce, Legal and Public Affairs Manager with the Irish Penal Reform Trust, talking to Barry Lenehan on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Maya Dunphy dropped into Studio 7 this afternoon to talk to Catherine Thomas on The Ray D'Arcy Show, and she started off by admiring the host's bump.
Oh, sure, look it. And I feel as big as a small country, but...
Well, you don't look it, and I'm very envious. I'd love to have gone again, but...
Would you?
I would.
So
Tom, you know, people have that chat where they say... People, they do ask terrible questions. They go, do you not wish you'd started sooner? And like you, it's not as if I spent my 20s... you know, living in a hole, so we're not thinking about life. You know, life was different. I wanted to get in the property, and I hadn't met somebody. So, you know, I had Tom at 39. He's
okay.
Just turned 6.
Yes.
Over the summer. And it's just the way life works out. But, you know, it wasn't like I was wasting my time. It was just. And also, I think either you have your kids early and get your life back in your 40s, or you have your kids later and you do all the fun stuff in your 20s and 30s. And like, I will never feel like I've missed out. You know, the last year, I feel like, do you miss pubs and nightclubs? And I go, no.
And it's funny. Like, I was in Centre Parks a couple of weeks ago, and I saw this couple, and they had this tiny, tiny, like, the baby must have only been a couple of weeks old. Oh. And I started to get a bit of a panic. I went, how do I do it? What do we do?
And it will be amazing and magical. And
It will. And sure, look it, we're so blessed.
And you look amazing.
Thank you. So come here, Tom is 6.
He is.
Getting ready to go back to school.
Senior infants.
How has summer been with him? And because I know I've on your social, you've done quite a few staycations. You guys are like little adventurers together, you and
He's
Tom.
He's brilliant. Well, without risking, I don't want to get out the world's smallest violin, but the thing about single parenting, I mean, I've taken it all on my stride. I don't find it too difficult. Well, rarely do I find it too difficult. But there are certain times when it's highlighted. And I think things like bank holidays and summer holidays and Christmas are the times where it sort of comes to the fore, and people are talking about doing a week or two somewhere, and you're thinking, God, I don't really want to do that. So we broke down our holidays. So we did a night down in Gorey, we did two nights in Wexford, we did a few days in Galway, and then we're going to Limerick next week for two nights. So we've probably done maybe 10 days altogether, but we've divided them up. And the hotels around Ireland are amazing. Like Centre Parks. I'm obsessed with Centre Parks.
It's great.
Not a sponsored post, but I wish it was. and we're actually going back to Centre Parks in November for a Christmas weekend.
It was
a trip. I have loads of trips that I booked last year. And I said, once I've paid for stuff, I don't want the money back, because like you, I just love going places. Yeah. So just give me the credit. Just give me the credit.
And what's he like as a little traveller? Because I've just done a couple of weeks on the road with herself as well.
Yes.
And you do have those magic moments. And she's only three
she's
and a half.
Three, yeah.
But I'd imagine at six, you know, it's a lovely time to spend together, because you have them out of their environment, away from a screen, or, you know, you're kind of concentrating. All you do, you're relaxed. And all you're doing is kind of concentrating on them and them on you.
Yeah. And there are so many. It's funny because now I look for very different. I used to look for a really good bar and really good spa, and now I'm like, is there a playground, is there a kids pool? It's all very different, but I love it because I've done all the bars and spas. I've done 20 years of bars and spas, so now it's time for, you know, playgrounds. And it's funny because we were down in Amber Springs and Ferrycarrig, really nice family hotels, and you see all the parents queuing for the kids club so they can dump their kids and go to the bar, and Tom and I are doing the opposite because this is going to be sick making, but I love his company.
Yeah,
he's just great. He's like me. We got an upgrade in the last hotel. He's like, look at this room. He's like, oh my God, look at this room. He gets a real buzz from going places. And we always get the train down and we look at the hotel website before we get there. We plan what we're going to do. And he's great company. I was on a plane with him when he was 8 weeks old.
Yeah.
On my own. And that was terrifying. I was only going back from London. So he's been on like 100 flights. He hasn't gone anywhere too exotic.
And I think once you start early like that, now for some people, you know, the idea is terrifying. But I think if you do it and you kind of get over that first initial flight or the second one, it does make things easier. And I want to ask you then just about single parenting that you said there. Like during lockdown, how was that for you? Because a couple of friends of mine found it very, very difficult, you know, trying to single parent and not have a support bubble. There's a friend of mine, her parents live in the States. And
it's very hard.
Yeah. And so when everyone was reducing contacts, everybody was scared out of their minds. Nobody was mixing. That kind of level of isolation, she found that very, very hard.
Yeah.
And reached out, actually. There was a company or a community that she went and got involved with called Frollo. Is that what it's a kind of? It's a single parent community.
Yeah.
And she really got an awful lot of, you know, help and assistance and kind of support through there.
Yeah.
Which I'd never heard of before.
I mean, I'm actually a total loner. And the fun about lockdown
by
is
nature.
I was as a kid. I never went on girls' holidays to Spain or group trips. I was always just, and I've always thought, God, what's wrong with me? And then you get to about 14 and you go, it's just the way I am and it's fine. So I'm okay on my own. But since having Tom, I've realised the importance of having a bubble of people, a network around, because he needs friends. I don't want him to be a loner like me if he's not naturally that way inclined. So bizarrely, it had the opposite effect on me in lockdown, because I thought, you know, when you have the autonomy to choose not seeing people, it's fine. If it's taken away from you, you realise, oh, now I can't see anybody.
Yes.
And it's all ahead of you, but when they start school and the WhatsApp groups, oh my God, it's a baptism of fire. And
with
you are
all
not,
the parents' WhatsApp
groups. And
oh
you
God.
Are not going to, the worst thing when someone says, oh, anyone got a school booklet, and someone sends it, and then you got 27 thank yous. We know, just sit in one thank you. So just stop. And just because you've both had a baby, you and another woman or a man, it doesn't mean you are going to have anything in common other than that.
Okay.
So, you know, you have to choose your friends wisely. But I've met a couple of really nice mums in the school, and one of them lives very close by. And you remember the first bit of lockdown when we were washing our groceries and, you know, pressing lift buttons with tissues
it
and things.
It just feels like another world.
I know, but it was such an awful time. And after about 8 weeks, I was going to see my parents and standing outside their house and waving in the window, you know, doing all those things that we were told to do at the time. But this now friend of mine, Emma, she said, we have a garden. And she said, do you want to come up and just have a drink in the garden? We can just keep 6 feet away. And I was like, yeah, I'd love that actually. So we did. And then we did that kind of once a week. And we kept our distance and we stayed outside. But, you know, after a while, you learned of what you could and couldn't do safely. Mm. And that was a real lifeline. Because it's funny, when the choice is taken away from you to be alone or not, you realise that maybe you do need people more than you might have thought.
Maya Dunphy sharing parenting and lockdown strategies with Catherine Thomas on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. On Monday's Ryan Tuberty Show, the topic of bystander intervention was discussed. It was touched on again yesterday, and this morning, Ryan spoke to Professor Louise Crowley, coordinator of UCC's bystander intervention course, about what to do and what not to do when you see someone in a hostile or difficult situation in public.
Very briefly, I'll tell you what we do here in UCC.
Thank you. Yeah, please.
And then we'll go to your situation. So back in about 2016, I really felt like that as an educational institution that we were perfectly positioned to educate and empower our students to develop an awareness of, you know, their own social responsibility, help them to identify unacceptable behaviour, which is a real challenge given the normalisation of sexual misconduct and, you know, the sexualisation of interactions more so in recent years, and for them to realise they don't have to live like that. And then in turn, once they have that understanding and the complexities of sexual harassment and violence and hostility, to then develop the skills to be empowered to do something about it, and to do something about it safely and effectively. So whilst it's positioned very much within the context of sexual harassment and violence, and part of the broader national framework to address sexual harassment and violence at third level, the skills that our students develop, and our staff as well, develop are very transferable and can be utilised in any situation where unacceptable behaviour is identified by somebody not directly involved, so a third party or a bystander. Allow them to identify it, so that, and then develop that sense of, well, it's not me, but I should do something about it. This is my society. This is my campus. You know, we want to change things. And then how to do it safely. And maybe that's where we can start talking now about your own situation, Ryan, and the different ways somebody can respond.
Well, let me give you an example. I was talking to the guy. He does takeaway deliveries, and he was saying to me, "Oh, listen, I heard you about your own story during the week," and I said, "That's fine." He said, "Funny thing happened the previous night." So he was working in this particular takeaway, and there was a woman working behind the counter, and a guy came in, probably about 16 years old, and the guy I'm talking about was sitting down, minding his own business, you know, waiting for the next delivery to do. Guy came in, wouldn't wear a mask. Now, this is not about anti-mask, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to confuse people with this. This is about how to deal with an aggressive situation. And he, the lady behind the counter said, "Excuse me, you have to put your mask on." And he said, he mentioned it made expletives and was aggressive. The guy, the delivery man, and he's much more than that, but just for the purpose of this conversation, said, he was sitting there going, he said, he looked at me, he said, "Look, I'm not, I'm built like you, so I'm not going to take someone on." And he didn't know what to do with himself, because he desperately wanted to protect the person or mind them or just in solidarity. But he was afraid to take on the guy because he was a big enough guy. But eventually he did stand up, and he said he was nervous as hell, as I was during the week when something similar happened. Nervous as hell. But just not like, you know, it's like that movie Network. I'm just not, you're just not going to take it anymore, you know, and the rudeness and the civil lack of civil discourse and so on. And he did. He interrupted. He said to the guy, "You've got to," and he took him on. "You've got to wear the mask or you get out or whatever." And the guy then complied. But it was an ugly, ugly little moment. And the world is full of such ugly little moments.
They are. And it's very challenging in that moment because it can be so quick. You know, your decision has to be quite quick in terms of whether you intervene and then how you intervene. And I suppose what I'd say first, Ryan, is that, you know, there is no rule book as to, well, you should do this, you should say this or the other, because obviously every situation is different. It brings its own dangers, or, you know, the circumstances are different. So in turn, every intervention is going to be unique. And it's very much, I think, it's the person's instinct in terms of what they can do to be safe or to diffuse the situation. But I think really importantly, now, obviously in some situations, and, you know, I've had students come back to me and said, you know, "I came upon a man attacking a woman, you know, and I got involved, physically involved." And those types of situations happen, and they often require that physical confrontation. But the reality is that most interventions don't need to be confrontational. And I think that there are so many skills that people can develop, and the awareness of those different means of intervention. So, I mean, you know, when we're working with staff and students here in UCC, we talk about, you know, you can make direct interventions before something ever happens. So red flags, you know, we talk about you're in a nightclub and you're with your friend and some guy's getting very close on the dance floor and it's unwanted. So rather than go over and tell, you know, have it out with him, you know, say to your friend, "Come on, we'll go to the loo." Or even if your own friend is acting inappropriately, you know, maybe causing trouble on the street, you know, rather than, again, get into trouble, you know, "Come on, I'm starved, let's go for pizza." Now, that might sound kind of glib, but you'd be amazed, because to distraction, removing someone from a situation can stop something before it ever starts.
Do you know what? That is so interesting, because I heard another story from a young person was telling me the other day about her friend who was on a train going down the country, up the country, I don't know where. Either way, there was a fella sitting in the quartet of seats, and there was just a presence about him, and there was a kind of like a physicality and movement about him that was just not savoury. And another woman sitting in nearby saw this, and out of the blue said to this young woman that I'm talking about, said, Harriet Mary made up a name. I hadn't seen you for a year. Come over. Let's catch. And totally rescued this person from the situation. Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. Like, obviously, is that the kind of example you're talking about?
So exactly. So our program is about four modules online. The students and staff do it self-directed, but we finish it with an in-person workshop. Now, it's been online for the last 18 months, but we go through scenarios like that. So another one we have is you're on a bus and, you know, a football team comes on and they're drunk and they're messy and they start calling out to some woman on the bus, or your guard just, I'd like a bit of you. And then the question to the group is, well, what would you do? And it's fascinating to hear what people say. So typically maybe a guy in the room, and I don't mean to be gender specific, but this is how it plays out. So there's a guy in the group in the workshop, he says, oh, I'd go up and I'd tell him to cop on. And I'd say, I'll say to them, well, would you go up by yourself? You know, would you go over to the 10 of them by yourself?
Good luck with that.
And then he says, And then, so then we talk about getting allies. So that's something else. So from your own example, on Monday, so what struck me immediately was, you know, that may have been a difficult situation. We're very conscious of the woman and the trouble that might be caused by an intervention. So one example for you could be, oh, I'm lost, can you tell me where O'Connell Street is now? You might get away with that, but you know, the rest of us might. Where there is deep hostility, very often it's about getting allies. So often we say to the students, you know, if you're in a nightclub and there's something troubling going down, get the bouncer, get the barman. You know, that you don't have to be the one that in reaching out for someone else better positioned, that in itself could be the most appropriate intervention, because the golden rule is always intervene only if it's safe. Never put yourself in danger, because you're doubling down and that's no good to anybody. But going back to the bus example, you know, so then we say, you know, maybe you could call, pick up with a couple of people. And then there's always, so someone else usually says, oh, I'd go sit with the woman. And I think that is powerful.
Right.
Go sit with the woman who's being yelled at, because you know it's not safe for you to go down to the lads. But actually, sit with the woman in solidarity, and that can diffuse the situation. The boys know they've been spotted. She feels safe, and you get her home. Obviously, go to the bus driver. You know, there's other different ways of doing it. But it's about understanding the breadth of capacity for how you can intervene and when you can intervene. You know, the allies, and also then calling the guards, of course. Mm. Always call the guards. Like that awful situation you recounted for somebody just before we spoke. You know, that type of an intervention, allies straight away springs to mind, but even then that sounded vicious. Getting the guards and keeping on the line. We have another role play where someone's being assaulted in their home and their roommate goes into another room and calls the guards and talks the guards through it as they drive up Gillaby Street heading up for UCC, you know, in our scenario, which are all localised. So, and what's fascinating too is the feedback we get back from participants. So the students, we do focus groups, and, you know, one student has said to us, you know, I was out on Saturday night and, you know, something happened and I spoke up, and just like you said in the workshop, other people stepped in and supported me, because the challenges, and particularly for young people who we're working with who are 19, 20, peer pressure, trying to fit in, you know, audience inhibition is a big reason why people don't intervene. But they know if other people in UCC have taken this program, when one person steps up, they know to row in behind, because they recognize, oh, this is an intervention and my role is to support the person who's been brave enough to speak up first. So it's about that cultural piece, Ryan. It's about, it's not enough if one person knows to intervene. For me, it's about everybody recognizing their role, even though they're a bystander. If they walk by or they laugh at the rape joke, as far as I'm concerned, they're part of the problem. Now, it's different in a dangerous situation, but in the daily sexual hostility that we know our students are experiencing, very often it's those, you know, subtle, you know, interventions, whether they're not laughing at a joke or telling someone to cop on, and then people rowing in behind. Suddenly the people who are perpetrating realize they're actually not in the majority. They're actually not hilarious. And that shatters the false consensus that we know they believe they have. So, you know, it's about that group sharing of responsibility, you know, in terms of recognizing the role that you have to play.
Wise words from Professor Louise Crowley, coordinator of UCC's Bystander Intervention course, on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. A parish in County Louth has swapped the collection basket for a QR code so worshippers can donate with their smartphones. Father Paul Byrne, parish priest in Termon Fechan, County Louth, spoke to Philip Boucher Hayes on this morning's Today programme.
We have been having donations online through our parish website with the Payzone portal. And they developed the QR code about 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so as part of their promotion, they were asking, would we be interested? And naturally, we said yes.
So how does it work?
Well, we have a QR code for the, you mentioned a couple of the different donations, donation buttons. We have those QR codes displayed in the churches. So essentially, people come in, they just click on their camera on their phone, and it brings you through to the link on the website where you can make your donation.
Do you have them like in the newsletter or posted at the church door or where?
On the notice board in the church and in the newsletter.
Okay. And it is open to me if I thought that Father Byrne was particularly poor in his sermon this week. but I want to keep my donations for the upkeep of the roof of the church, that I can choose which one I want to go for, yeah?
You can, of course, because they're all separate codes.
And this is not the first innovation of this kind. When you think in your previous parish, you had a parish app. What was that?
Well, I remember at the time, this going back about 7 or 8 years ago, and as one of your contributors, because I was RT interviewed me that time, mentioned it was the parish in your pocket. So it was basically our parish website on an app, which meant that people could connect in with the parish on their phones rather than have to go through a website.
And does technological innovation, Paul, keep people interested in coming to Mass, do you think?
It does. We, you know, in both the previous parish and this one, we have been live streaming for years. We have a multimedia projector system in the church, and it does keep people connected, particularly those who not only come to church, but people who can't come as well.
Yeah. So it's not gimmicky. It is a way of making people say, I wonder what he's up to now. We must go and take a look at that.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you introduce these things in the beginning, people do sort of think maybe, some people would think maybe it's a bit of a gimmick. But, you know, we live in a visual age, Philip. You know, people are much more connected with us visually than orally. So, you know, like, for example, you know, with the multimedia overhead screens, we would use that for the likes of our parish notices, our hymn singing, and even sometimes my homilies.
Really? You put the homily almost as a PowerPoint presentation?
Sort of thing, yeah.
Good Lord. How have the congregation reacted to that?
Well, you see, if I wanted to draw attention to a particular image, you know, that maybe we're celebrating, say, for example, today we're celebrating the feast of St. Bernard of Clairvaux in France, you know, maybe to stick up an image of him so that people connect with, this is who you're talking about, or something like that.
Okay, and proof of the pudding is in the eating as far as the QR code substituting for the collection basket has gone. How are donations?
Well, as I was saying to your researcher, you know, we started this before Easter, and of course the churches were closed until June. So it's been slow but steady. You know, there has been money coming in through those.
All right.
The Catholic Church taking payments from your smartphone during Mass. It's like living in the future. They'll be ordaining women next. Kidding, of course they won't. Father Paul Byrne there, parish priest in Termon Fechan, County Louth, talking to Philip Boucher Hayes on this morning's Today programme. A confession. For a long time, I thought a pine marten was a type of bird. I'm not saying I saw one and thought it was a bird. I'm saying I heard the name and thought it was referring to a bird. Lol, I know. Apparently, it's not a bird. In fact, it's a protected species of mammal that is apparently very elusive and, judging by this afternoon's live line, quite a cross little beastie. Just ask Joanne, whose car was torn to shreds by a pine marten, as she told Joe Duffy.
On Wednesday morning, Joe, I went out to our family car and just greeted with the car was absolutely destroyed. It was all soiled. There was parts of the car, the leather of the car eaten away, all the car seats the kids sit on, they were all soiled, and the roof was all pulled down in the back where the kids sit, underneath the visors, the sun visors in front of the car. All the roof was just destroyed, chunks taken out of it. The floor has been ripped up off the car as well, Joe. So I went in to my husband and he came out and he started to pull the car apart. And I had shopping bags in the back of the car, the Aldi ones with the foil inside, you know.
Okay.
And as he went to take out, to pull out the shopping bag, he jumped out of it and he ran up the centre of the car.
Oh, you saw the culprit?
Yeah, we saw him. Oh, yeah. Yeah, we saw him.
And
yeah.
he or she was clearly an adult pine marker.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was a big... It was like a substantial size, Joe, now. You know, like, I just saw him and he darted through the centre of the seats and he ran up then onto the floor and went in underneath the brake or the pedals of the car and just disappeared. So we just knew that he was still in the car. So Fergus closed all the doors straight away. And he was inside in the car, like we don't know whether he was in at the back of the radio or he was in the glove compartment area. He wasn't in the glove compartment. He was behind it. He had found some little spot and stayed there. And he didn't venture out, Joe, on all that day. We set put in a cage and we put some food into it and he never came out at all that whole day. Fergus covered the car in black polythene and tried to lure him out, I suppose, to make him think that it was night time, but he didn't. And that night before we went to bed, Fergus went out to check the car and he wasn't in the cage. There was no sign of him. But Fergus went out at about 3 o'clock and he could hear him in the car and he had done like loads of damage.
He was off again. He was walking away again.
He was working away again, Joe. Yeah, he was. Fergus didn't know whereabouts he was, but he could hear him, like, you know.
And what, did we hear him gnawing? Is that it, or...?
Gnawing and, I don't know, whatever noises they make. But he was busy at work, like, ripping up parts of the car as well. Like, obviously, Fergus was afraid, like,
It's a big car. It's a Kia Carens. That's a seven-seater.
It's a seven-seater, yeah.
And is it destroyed?
I should have actually said, Joe, actually, when Fergus went out, he was in the bag that is just directly behind or beside the seat that my son sits in every day, you know. So, like, I was bringing my son down to cool camps that morning, so Louis would have sat in the seat.
But I don't think do pine martens attack humans?
Well, I don't know, Joe. I didn't wait around to see.
What's the state of your car now?
Oh, it's destroyed. It's absolutely destroyed.
Wow.
I'm terrified.
Your phone line is going in and out. Is it a write-off?
Well, I can't ever see us being able to sell it on at this stage, Joe, because there's such a substantial amount of damage done. Does it still move? The ignition starts, but the airbag is on. He has etched the wire for the airbag on the passenger side.
That's the end of
it. So, you know, it's a huge amount of damage. I rang my insurance company and they just wiped their hands off at Joe and they said that it's not covered.
Why not?
Because he's vermin, they said, and I asked, he's wildlife and he's vermin. And I said, are all wildlife animals referred to as vermin? And she told me no. I asked her why he was vermin. She said, because he ate rodents. And
But the pine marten is the rarest mammal native to Ireland.
And protected.
You cannot kill them.
No.
So you can kill rats.
Yeah.
You can kill mice.
Yeah. Absolutely, Joe, yeah.
A farmer can kill a fox.
Mm-hmm.
There are nearly 300,000 legally held guns in Ireland, shotguns. for killing foxes and other vermin. So why would the state decide that we are protecting a rat, that no one can kill a rat?
I have no idea, Joe.
Because he's not a rat. Now,
I've asked them to put in writing.
How did he get into the car?
I have absolutely no idea, Joe.
Okay. Was there anything in the car that would have attracted him? Any food? Any smells? What was the smell in the car?
Well, I suppose, we have an air freshener in the car. Okay,
what fragrance is the air freshener?
I don't know. I think it's a little chub-a-chub kind of an air freshener that I have in it for the kids.
They love berries, apparently.
Yeah.
Would there have been the smell of strawberries, raspberries?
Strawberries or something,
from the chub-a-chub in the car?
Easily, yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's that kind of a...
So the car, I'm looking at you, it's a 132 Kia Cairns. It was in great condition. I'm looking up websites earlier. It's worth at least 10 grand. Now it's more to replace it, unfortunately, for you. But to buy a new one, to buy a 132, I don't know what condition it's in, will cost you at least 10 grand.
Yeah, and Joe, the funds aren't there. We didn't anticipate this. We insure our car in good faith, every year, right on the button. It's fully comprehensive. It's a good policy insofar as that my no claims bonus.
It's a 7-seat year. You use it for school runs and football runs, and you bring the neighbours and whatever. It's really important. Stay with us, Joanne. Joanne is in County Leitrim. You don't want to use your second name at this stage, Joanne. Is that what I mean?
Not if I can, Joe. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's perfectly fine. But are you embarrassed about it, or?
I am, I suppose.
Why?
Well, it's our family car.
It's the last thing you'd expect.
Joe, to be honest with you, I'm totally rattled by it. To be honest, I'm devastated. I didn't expect it. And then, you ring your insurance company and you pay it out. You hope that. Then when something happens to you, that they'll look after you. And they literally wiped their hands off the situation and told me it wasn't covered.
Well, then, I think you mentioned to me there, you're going to appeal it. They kind of dismissed you pretty sharply, didn't they? Oh, no, Pine Martin is a vermin. It's not.
I don't think initially when I rang that they were even kind of... I had to tell them twice or three times that it was a pine marten and what I was talking about. And
you were saying
spell Martin to the girl that was on the phone.
Did you think it was a relative of Dean Martin or something? M-A-R-T-E-N, pine marten. I'm sure they haven't heard it before. A pine marten at my car. Because that's what's happened. He's destroyed your car. It's gone. It's a write-off.
Joanne in County Leitrim telling Joe Duffy on Liveline how a pine marten chewed up her 7-seater and how her insurance company refused to pay for the damage. What is it like trying to flee Afghanistan as the Taliban take control? Gesu Yari, former government civil service commissioner with the Afghan government, spent 2 nights without food and sleep in an effort to flee with her family. She spoke to Philip Boucher-Hayes on the Today programme this morning from Poland.
Before I leave the country, I actually decided to relocate my house because the second day the Taliban entered Kabul, they started home searches. They collected all the government employees' armored cars and the guns they were containing for their securities in the houses. I had to relocate and leave my apartment, and I was hidden with also my husband and also my siblings and my family and my mother. Everybody, we have to be evacuated from our permanent house. So the second night when I was coordinated with some friends
What night was that, Gesu, that you left? Was that Friday, Saturday?
Saturday, because Saturday when we noticed, I was outside when they said the government is going to collapse today, and then A lot of my colleagues called from the government and asked me if they have to stay. I told them no, leave. I left my armored car in the office. I used a personal car to go to the bank, but the banks ran out of cash. And then the next day, which was on Sunday, the banks also closed and all the money froze. I didn't have any cash with me. And then that Saturday night, everything got intensified. And then I was noticed, I have some friends who are working in the security sectors. They contacted me to leave my house because they entered Kabul. Okay. So that Saturday night, I left Kabul.
Had the Americans promised you a place on a plane for you and your extended family?
It was extremely hard because I contacted the ambassador of the U.S. And I emailed, I said, listen, I applied for my husband who was supposed to go with me in January. Can you expedite the process? And also, I want to put myself on the evacuation list. They didn't have any forms to fill out initially. They said, I will be on the list, but I had to coordinate with a lot of organizations in Washington to be connected and so that they can put me on the list and my husband and my whole family.
I don't understand that. Why were the Americans being so bureaucratic about this, Gacy? I mean, surely it's pretty obvious that you're somebody who needs to be evacuated.
The demand was very high. You know what was this? The sad part was that I was holding a U.S. citizenship and I still had to go through all these layers to get my family out. And at the end of the day, I couldn't get my family out. I mean, my brother and my mother and their children are still in Kabul. The only people I took with me was the support of the Polish people and also my husband who came with me. So the checkpoints, going back to your actual question, the checkpoints were extremely hard. When we were noticed that we have to leave, me and my husband left, we had to go to the main entrance of the airport we usually use to travel outside. When we got there, we thought that was the right gate. We got out of the car, me and my husband just walking with our backs to go to the gate, and we were stopped by the Taliban.
Sorry, can I interrupt you for 1 second? Before that, at the checkpoints, did you lie? Did you tell them who you were? Did you say that you were being evacuated by the Americans?
No, we were not stopped in the first checkpoint. The checkpoints actually started building right after we left. So that was not the initial step. So because it got really crowded, they had to control everything. They had to put a checkpoint. So when we stopped and then they asked us where we were going, we showed them our passport. We said we were going to the airport. They just laughed at us, sarcastically told us that there is no flights. You think you're going to leave the country? You will not be able to leave the country. Just go back. So we resisted it. We said we have to go. And then they pushed my husband and asked him to leave. So we got scared. They started firing on the air. We just ran away. And then we asked my brother to come back and pick us up. We left to a friend's house. And then we were called that we have to go to the right gate. That's where the British and the European Union countries are evacuating people. We got there, and there was two, it wasn't a checkpoint. It was, you know, the Taliban standing there. You just had to talk to them, tell them that you're going in. There wasn't any cars or any
And what were the scenes like there, Gesu? Because I'm looking right now at the television pictures, horrifying pictures of tiny, tiny little babies being handed over the barbed wire into the soldiers on the other side. Was that a scene that was replicated right the way around the airport?
Well, it got worse when we left because our flight was the first flight to Poland. It got really worse right after us because my sisters got today. They told me my niece, my nephew, who is 14 years old, actually experienced the same thing as this child you see on the television. Because that was the only way. They had to go on top of the car and then the soldiers on the other side had to pick them up. That was the only way that they would cross. There was no other options. I mean, the streets were terrifying. I spent from 7 in the at night or 8 o'clock at night until 8 in the morning for 12 hours. I was on the streets. On my one side, it was Taliban who were fighting. On the other side, the British soldiers, and there was later Turkish soldiers because they're evacuating their people. They were firing on the air because people were they were creating a huge crowd that was out of control. And then when it got very worse around 1 o'clock, I think there was some high profile talibs were coming in to check the situation. I don't know why they came in. And then 4 talibs had their lashes. Then they started beating people to find a way for the car to come in. And then people were running around. I remember on my right side, there was a French resident who I think was either diplomat or was a, for some reason was in Afghanistan. He was beaten by the Taliban and was kicked, and he lost his phone. He ran away, and I was the next person, and I ran away and I cried. I told my husband that we have to leave, we have to go home. I cannot stay like this for the whole night. It's not going to be possible to cross the border. We had to hide somewhere. When we hid in a corner, a Talib came to me and asked me that, sister, you have to leave. I said, I can't leave. I have to go to the airport. And he said, you cannot cross. You cannot go. You will not have any flights. I said, I have my passport and I have an email. I have to leave. He just looked at me and said, my last time, I'm going to ask you to leave. And then he got busy with other people. And then I ran away with my husband. We found another corner to hide. And then later on, we found a brilliant Yakoda journalist, a Polish journalist who is very famous here in Poland. And I was connected with her, and she helped all the 200 Afghans who were leaving to Poland, every single one of them, to cross this gate. If I think she was a superhero, if she was not there, I don't think any Afghans would be able to cross that gate.
What did she say
gate.
That persuaded the Taliban to let you all in?
Well, it wasn't the Taliban. We already passed that gate.
Okay.
It was too crowded and in front of the gate. We wouldn't be able to see the Polish military. We wouldn't get to them. We were blocked totally. So what she did, she was in a close contact with the embassy in India. And then they were connected together with the military people. And she was basically at night around 2 o'clock until 8 in the morning, she made a circle, and then 40 people got together, and then we had to sit in the same place. And then she went to talk to the Taliban and told them that these all belong to the Polish, to the Poland, and I'm going to take them out and they shouldn't be harmed, and you're going to ask all these people around to not harm them. That's what her conversation was all about.
Nice.
And then we basically got together around 8 o'clock. It was extremely hard to cross the border. She collected all our passports, and then she gave it to the security people to check it with the list. One by one, we were, I don't know how to describe the scene. It was as if we couldn't hold hands, we wouldn't be able to cross. And a lot of people who did not even have documents, they were trying to run in. And then the military people had to fire on the air to control them. Otherwise, it would be a mess in that door.
When you eventually did get onto the plane, Gesu, did you collapse?
Well, because we didn't eat for 2 days and we didn't sleep, we were on the street. I think the first thing we did in the plane, it was an Air Force plane. It was too noisy. And with the fact that it was a noise going on and wasn't a comfortable seat, I took a nap.
Okay.
Because I think I probably needed that.
Gesu Yari, former government civil service commissioner with the Afghan government, telling Philip Boucher Hayes how she and her family escaped the country on this morning's Today programme. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Nilo Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another Playback Daily at the same time on Monday. But for me, thank you for listening and good luck.